Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is A20-1134, a minor by and through her mother and natural guardian, Amber Nelson versus Fairview Health Systems et al. And Alina Health System et al. We are hearing this oral argument on the Zoom platform today in accordance with pandemic-related court orders. The procedural rules that apply to this Zoom oral argument are the same that apply to our in-person oral argument. We are recording the oral argument, and I'll remind our viewers that no other recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. The counsel for each party will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Marshall is keeping time in one of the grid rectangles on the Zoom view. You should be able to have a better view of it when you start your oral argument. With that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed, and I'll ask that you please identify yourself and the party you represent at the start of your argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. My name is Paul Brandis, and I have the privilege of representing the minor plaintiff in this case. We're here today because the district court clearly erred in requiring the minor plaintiff to rule out her periviability in fully explaining her complications. And in so doing, the district court erected an insurmountable barrier to her ability to meet her burden regarding reliability, and thereby stack the deck against her, and that by definition is an abuse of discretion. The district court required her to prove that the very thing the defendants were required to protect her against, in other words, prematurity by itself without the benefit of steroids, was not the thing that injured her, when everyone in the case agreed that that was the thing that was injured her. In other words, unprotected prematurity, unprotected by the necessary steroids. The defense was simply that whatever care the appellant, the plaintiff, says should have been given would not have made a difference. But the district court essentially asked the minor plaintiff to show that the cause was really not the cause when it was the cause and everybody agreed it was the cause. And that's exactly what this case is about, the failure to protect her from that cause. Prematurity, in other words, without steroids, is not a plausible alternative, as that term is used in the McDonough case, given that it was the cause. And that's what the defendants had a duty under the standard of care to protect her against. So consequently, as our expert, Dr. Hillman, said, had she not been premature, we wouldn't be here. And that's exactly correct. But the district court interpreted that as a statement that he was conceding that he failed to consider a plausible alternative when that's not really a plausible alternative. The injuries she suffered are those of prematurity and exactly the injuries steroids are aimed at preventing. And the testimony was at the hearing that we know premature babies, like the minor plaintiff, or at risk for injury, and that is why medicine has developed steroids to protect them from those ill effects. As the experts on both sides actually said, steroids, antenatal steroids, is one of the greatest advancements in obstetrics and neonatal medicine starting in the 1990s. And while they're not foolproof to prevent the consequences, given that all premature babies are at some risk, whether or not they get steroids, steroids significantly reduces that risk, and as the experts testify, Dr. Hillman, more likely than not in this case, they would have been effective. And
so help me here with the foundational basis for the conclusion that the course of steroids would have more likely than not alleviated the damages in this case. Well, what are the best studies that Dr. Hillman cites in support of that proposition?
Dr. Hillman cited to the studies that went up to 26 weeks, that started from 26 weeks gestation, which were the ones that they stopped at because they found such a profound effect. And then they stopped doing randomized controlled trials at that point because, it, as he said, it would have been unethical to withhold them from 23 and 24 weekers because they were so good at doing what they did. And then he cited to a variety of peer review articles where they looked at cohorts, groups of premature babies before 2011, which was the date of the carrot issue here. And they looked at scores and scores and hundreds of babies, comparing those who had received antenatal steroids and those who did not receive antenatal steroids. And they found this continuing benefit of those that received antenatal steroids were significantly in better shape and would go on to lead, in a majority of the circumstances, a relatively normal life, if not a completely normal life.
But isn't the real question, though, whether any of those studies show that the treatment, the course of treatment, would reduce the risk of complications by some margin above 50%? So you get that more likely than not. I mean, otherwise, I think that the concern is that we're in speculation territory on causation.
Well, that's the dichotomy between general causation and specific causation, Your Honor. On general causation, there is no duty to present evidence that there was a greater than 50% chance. On general causation, you simply have to prove that there was a chance. And then on specific causation, you have to prove that under the facts and circumstances of this specific case, the minor plaintiff would have fallen into that group of patients who would have received a benefit. And Dr. Hillman specifically testified, based on the literature and based on his experience, that steroids do provide a substantive benefit. Under Kodrowski and the other cases in the Supreme Court, there is no obligation to quantify the differences. He testified that there is a substantive benefit to steroids versus not having steroids. And he testified on specific causation as to the circumstances of this child's case as to why she would have benefited. The Supreme
Court. So, Mr. Brandis,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
No. You
correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the record reflects that there was one dose of steroids given. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, in terms of the literature, which articles are applicable to the situation before us?
They are all applicable to the situation before you because the testimony was, Your Honor, that the articles that were presented that talked about one dose of steroids, they said you will start to have some effect after 6 hours. However, the minor plaintiff here did not get the benefit of 6 hours. She only got the benefit of 4 hours. Consequently, all of the literature states that just getting steroids for 4 hours doesn't provide any benefit. And so all of the articles in this case are directly relevant, as cited by Dr. Hillman, to his opinions on general causation and specific causation. The fact that...
So in this case, if I understand you correctly, you're suggesting that this infant is even though the infant received a dose of steroids, the infant in effect is equivalent to an infant who didn't receive any doses for study purposes because it was only within a 4-hour window.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, and did Dr. Hillman address that in his testimony?
He did, Your Honor, and he did cover the article that talked about the 6-hour time frame as the minimum amount of time before you would start to see some type of benefit or change, or the start of it, I should say.
And I'm sorry, can you just direct me where in the record I would look to confirm that?
I will get that for Your Honor in 1 second. My colleague is sitting next to me and she's looking for it as we speak.
Thank you.
It was Exhibit P316, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Excuse me. So, Your Honors, just as medicine developed vaccines such as for measles, mumps, and rubella to protect children, to provide them with that armor, so too the steroids provide them with that armor. And you know, in a case where, for example, a doctor does not meet the standard of care by recommending that childhood vaccine, the child's unprotected from the measles, the mumps, and the rubella. And it's not appropriate then to have that child in that unprotected state somehow prove that the reason for him getting the measles was that unprotected state. Why else would he have gotten the measles lest he'd been or she'd been unprotected by the vaccine? The same holds true here with regard to steroids. Steroids are that armor that protects the unborn baby and then the newborn baby from the effects of the prematurity. That's what this case is about. It's about the failure to protect the baby from the known consequences of prematurity, which medicine does all the time in various areas. If a person is at risk for something, there are medicines to protect them from that risk. And here the case is about the negligence and failing to protect this child from that known risk. And we didn't just bring any old expert into court. We brought Dr. Hillman into court. He's one of the country's leading experts in this field. He studied it. He's written about it. He's treated it for 20 years. He testified that he treats 6 to 10 premature babies like the minor plaintiff every month since about 2011. He testified that he's treated 23 and 24 weakers who got a complete course, who got a partial course, and who got no course of steroids. And by experience alone, he knows the effects of each and the different signs and symptoms and the treatment courses neonatally. Unlike in McDonough, he didn't give boilerplate answers or denials without support. Unlike McDonough, he considered and ruled out other factors that could have been reasonably possible causes for the injuries or the decompensation shortly after delivery. He ruled out genetics. He ruled out infection. He ruled out hypoxia in utero. He ruled out ischemia in utero. He even ruled out autism. He ruled out all of the potential, reasonably potential causes. And obviously, he can't rule out prematurity because prematurity is what causes this minor plaintiff's complications absent the steroids.
Can you address more specifically specific causation?
Yes, sir. So Dr. Hillman testified that he testified as to the mechanism of steroids and how it improves the lung maturation. He testified as how it improves the vasculature. It makes the lungs more elastic. It makes the vessels more elastic. It gets rid of the germinal matrix in the brain, which is where the bleeds are prone to, the intraventricular hemorrhages. And then he went from, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I just want to make sure you get the focus of my question. I'm looking more for the support for the what you described as that second level where you now need to show as to causation that this particular child fits within that that preponderance of the evidence.
Right. And so what he testified to is he looked specifically at the baby's condition at birth. And he found that the baby had a normal blood pH, which means the baby was not hypoxic or suffering from ischemia. He found that the baby had initially been on CPAP, didn't have to initially go on be ventilated. That was a further prognostic factor that the baby was actually trying to do pretty well, but ultimately failed and needed the ventilation. He covered all of the baby's consequences. He found that the baby then started to decompensate, and with the pneumothoraxes, that then caused the code event, that then caused the bleeds and the brain injuries. So he went down that path of looking at this child's specific circumstances. What was her condition at birth? What were her lab values at birth? And how she was responding initially. She had good Apgar scores, for example. And he then found that she needed to be intubated because her lungs did not have the benefit of being matured by steroids. And because of that ventilation, and because her lungs were therefore not elastic or prepared for outside life, she developed holes in her lungs from that ventilation process, these pneumothoraxes, which then resulted in her going into cardiopulmonary arrest, having to be resuscitated. And those pressure changes due to that, those pneumothoraxes, those cardiopulmonary arrest, that resuscitation is what resulted in the now fragile brain, which still had the germinal matrix, starting to bleed and going from a grade one intraventricular hemorrhage, which is essentially harmless, was the testimony, to a grade three intraventricular hemorrhage and cerebellar hemorrhage, which is what caused the brain injury in this case. So he covered all of the items on specific causation, outlining for the court each of those things. And here, the question is not whether or not Dr. Hillman is right or wrong. It's whether or not he illustrated for the district court a reasonable basis for his opinions. It's ultimately for the jury to determine whether or not he's right or wrong. It's for the court to serve as the gatekeeper to determine, does he have the bona fides? Does he have the goods here to support his opinions? And that's what Dr. Hillman did, both on general causation and on specific causation. And I see my time is running, so I'll stop here, Your Honors, unless you have some questions.
Thank you. It doesn't look like there are any further questions at this time. I just want to clarify, is one counsel arguing for all respondents?
That's correct. I will be arguing for the respondents. Ms. Nearing is on standby if the court has any questions for Alina.
Okay, thank you. You can proceed when you're ready, and if you can please introduce yourself at the start of your argument, we would appreciate it.
I am Rebecca Moose for the Fairview defendants and also for the Alina respondents insofar as the main argument is going. I'm going to focus my argument on the appeal brought by appellants, not the Fairview cross appeal, but I'm happy to answer any questions the court may have about that cross appeal. If it please the court, counsel, I'm going to start by directly focusing on the questions posed by Judge Frisch and Judge Cochran as to what are Dr. Hillman's strongest studies in support of his causation opinion. I counted 12 articles in Dr. Hillman's direct exam that he relied upon for his opinions. Nine of those do not compare outcomes between antenatal steroids and partial antenatal steroids or no antenatal steroids. They deal with other issues, and Dr. Hillman admitted on cross-examination that those articles did not address comparison of outcomes between exposure to steroids and no exposure to steroids. Two of the articles dealt with exposure to steroids versus no exposure to steroids, and those studies, and they were exhibits P306 and P315, they defined exposure to steroids as any steroids, one dose. And Dr. Hillman admitted on cross-examination that Tuesday Peck fell within the group that was exposed to steroids in those studies. So those studies do not help support the causation opinion. There was one study, and that's exhibit P-309, which did compare outcomes between steroid exposure, part that was full, partial steroid exposure, and no steroid exposure. And that study, it's P-309, and there is a table three in that study. And it shows that 69% of babies who have full exposure have improved outcomes. But when you compare them to the partial exposure, Tuesday Peck's group, 65% had improved outcomes. So that's just a difference of 4 percentage points. That's not more likely than not causation. In fact, all babies were more likely than not to have good outcomes in that study, even if they got no exposure whatsoever. That does not support the causation opinion offered by Judge Hillman. Another study that just dealt with the intervals between giving the steroids but did not and delivery, but did not compare outcomes. It is it's entirely agreed by all experts that babies born at periviable gestational ages before 26 weeks are at high risk for the exact outcomes a Tuesday Peck had. Her respiratory problems, her brain bleed, cerebral palsy, developmental delays, retinopathy of prematurity, those are high-risk issues for those babies. And in the defense testimony by Dr. Goldsmith, our neonatologist, he discussed outcomes for these periviable babies, and he identified articles in the defense exhibit 112, and one of them's under tab 4, which showed that babies like Tuesday Peck had a 75% or more chance of death or significant neurologic impairment. The plaintiff's burden in this case is, this is a medical malpractice case. It's not a toxic tort. Plaintiff's burden is to show more likely than not causation. More likely than not, the failure to give Tuesday Peck a full course of steroids caused her current deficits. Plaintiff also has the burden to show that but for the alleged negligent treatment, Tuesday Peck would be fine or have only minimal deficits. But she has not done that. And keep in mind that all the experts agree that even if treatment had been entirely as appellant alleges, Tuesday Peck still would have been born at less than 26 weeks. She was born at 24 weeks and one day, even with all the treatment. Pregnancy only would have been prolonged 48 hours, and that would have taken her to, at best, 24 weeks and 2 days. So she still was going to be periviable and vulnerable to the exact problems that she has had. I want to address the argument that the district court engaged in fact-finding. And at, I think it's paragraphs 28 of the court's decision, it sets out exactly the process that he followed in coming to his conclusion that Dr. Hillman's opinion simply did not have reliability. He notes that the Cochrane review, which Dr. Hillman testified is the gold standard, the Cochrane review did not show more likely than not causation. At any age, the Cochrane review reported on babies born after 26 weeks, and even the outcomes in that age group were not more likely than not resolved. The complications were not resolved by steroids. In fact, Cochrane said that there simply is not adequate data to address the outcomes of effective steroids at babies who are less than 26 weeks. And district court noted that. The district court then went on to say that Dr. Hillman relied on a number of observational studies, which is also correct. And as I just explained to you, those observational studies do not show more likely than not causation. They show, in fact, they disprove causation because steroids are not more likely than not to prevent these outcomes in babies born at 24 weeks. The district court then points
out. Counsel, with regard to P309, for babies that had no steroid exposure, what was the outcome percentage there? In other words, as I understood appellant's argument, I think counsel was arguing that the baby in this case should be considered to have had no exposure. Now, you may disagree with that. But in terms of his argument and whether P309 provides any support in terms of Dr. Hillman's proposed opinion, can you address that aspect?
Right. The with complete exposure, this is Table 3, Exhibit P309, and it's on page 309.6. with complete exposure, 69% were reported to have intact survival. With partial treatment, 65% had intact survival. And with no treatment at all, 55.6% were reported to have intact survival.
Thank you.
Still does not show more likely than not. And P309, it sounds like the survival, the outcomes reported are quite optimistic, but it does not include death. And death is a major outcome. And that is why parents are authorized to decline any treatment, even resuscitation, when patients are born, babies are born before 25 weeks. I was going on to explain that the district court then went through to describe the differential diagnosis that Dr. Hillman offered. And as Mr. Brandis pointed out correctly, Dr. Hillman ruled out genetic problems and problems during labor and delivery or some prenatal type of problem. But he never said in his direct examination, and that's when he has to say it, it has to come from him, that in fact, I have ruled out periviability itself as a cause, regardless of steroid treatment. That is not in the record anywhere. On cross-examination, I brought that out. And I said, Dr. Hillman, I heard you rule out various other potential causes, but I did not hear you rule out periviability itself, regardless of treatment, as the cause. And he essentially said, that's right. So that is the basis for the district court to say, this is a faulty differential diagnosis. The opinion is not reliable and it's not admissible. Well, appellant argues, you know, an expert really doesn't have to rule out all other possible causes. But that's not quite accurate. The case appellant relies on is the Ingram case, which was a motor vehicle accident case, and the expert was a treater. And the question was, could the treater render an opinion that the accident made the plaintiff's back injury worse than it had been before the accident? And the court held, yes, that was admissible. He didn't have to rule out all other potential causes of the back pain that the plaintiff was having. Well, that hardly is authority that says Dr. Hillman doesn't have to rule out periviability itself as a cause in this case. He simply is required to do that. The standard of review here is abuse of discretion. And abuse of discretion is present when the district court ignores the law or the district court makes a conclusion that's not supported at all by the record, that's contrary to the record, or that is illogical. This is not an abuse of discretion. The district court's findings are entirely supported by the record, the literature, and the testimony. And the record really is dependent on what did Dr. Hillman say. Arguments of counsel about what's in the documents, that's not adequate to support the proponent's expert opinion. That's fine for cross-examination, but the proponent has to have the doctor explain that, and that is not in this record.
And is it a fair characterization of the record to say that Dr. Hillman didn't reach that conclusion either based upon the available medical data or based on his own experience and training?
Well, he said, as far as his own experience and training is concerned, he says, you know, a physician's clinical experience, that's anecdotal. That can't be tested. It's just his recollection. So that's not a good basis for an opinion.
But even so, he didn't base the ultimate opinion on his training or experience, correct?
Well, I'm sure he mentioned his training and experience someplace in there, but he didn't ever elaborate why he could tell based on his clinical experience that this particular baby was going to be the one of those few babies that maybe does well with steroids. He never explained that.
Yeah.
So it really wasn't an adequate record to support his opinion and give it reliability. And if a physician's clinical experience is contradicted by the scientific evidence, it's not reliable. So we would ask that the district court be affirmed. I could go on and make more points, but I don't want to take the court's time unnecessarily. Unless you have questions or think I have failed to address a point made by Mr. Brandis. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Any rebuttal, Mr. Brandis?
Yes, Your Honors. Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Judge Cochran, you asked for a specific cite regarding that six-hour rule. I gave you the Exhibit 316. It was also covered by Dr. Hillman in his testimony on December 11th at pages 214 through 216 of his testimony. He specifically covered that issue. Additionally, Your Honor, defense counsel is incorrect. Dr. Hillman specifically stated in his direct testimony and in his cross-examination testimony, for example, on pages 64 of his December 12th transcript, he specifically said that the administration of steroids more likely than not would have resulted in Tuesday being born with no to little injury. It's specifically in his testimony that he covered that issue on causation, more likely than not. That's the gist of his testimony. So to say that it's not in the record is incorrect.
Mr. Brandis, if we conclude that the district court didn't abuse its discretion with regard to the differential diagnosis, what other evidence would support or would show that the district court abused its discretion in excluding Dr. Hillman's testimony?
Well, Rule of Evidence 702 specifically states that a witness can base his opinion on his experience.
Dr. Hillman acknowledge that his experience is anecdotal and wouldn't serve as the basis for a reliable opinion?
No, I don't believe he said that, Your Honor. I think what he said was that his experience is significant because beyond the testimony about the number of years of practice and the number of babies he treats, he says based on his experience, he can look at a baby and see the effects of steroids versus not no steroids and see what happens with babies with steroids versus no steroids and see their prognoses and understand their prognoses. He specifically testified to all of that, Your Honor. So he is entitled to rely on his experience. The foundational reliability of that experience you can look at by virtue of his testimony as to the number of babies he's treated over the course of the years and the research that he's done over the course of the years. This is not an expert that we pulled in who was a year out of residency, who has little or no experience treating these babies. We pulled in an expert who's a leader in this field, who testified to his experience and how that experience informs his judgments in this case. So I do believe that under Rule 702, experience is an independent basis upon which an expert can provide an opinion. As to the studies that defense counsel cited, claiming that the articles do not address comparisons of outcomes, several of those articles don't address comparisons of outcomes because all of the babies, or virtually all of the babies in those articles, received steroids because steroids is the standard of care. So they were looking at those babies to understand the impact of those steroids. And from that, fair inferences can be made about the absence of steroids because the expert testimony in this case was replete with information about how steroids impact the lungs, what happens with steroids impacting the brain, and what happens when those structures don't receive the benefits of steroids. The court in Kudrowski and the other Supreme Court cases specifically enumerates that an expert does not have to quantify, break it down into percentages, do anything of that nature in order for it to be a reasonably reliable opinion. In Kudrowski, the defense claimed that the expert didn't break down how the fuel pump, what percentage of it affected the fuel flow to the engine. And the Supreme Court says you don't have to break those things down into percentages. As long as you have a reasonably reliable basis for your opinion, it's for the jury then to decide whether or not that's sufficient to support a verdict one way or another. All that the district court is supposed to do at this stage is to determine whether or not there's a reliable basis for the opinions, not whether or not they're right or wrong, not whether or not there are gaps in the facts. It gaps in the facts. Disputes about what the literature says or doesn't say, that goes to weight, not admissibility. So any distinction about well, this article said this or this expert said that compared to what this other article said or what that other expert said. As long as plaintiff's experts have a reasonable foundation for their opinions, that's what counts. And the plaintiff's experts clearly had reasonable foundations for their opinions. Both Dr. Hillman and Dr. Onichi on the tocolysis magnesium sulfate issue. And for that reason, Your Honor, the district court needs to be reversed on Dr. Hillman and affirmed on Dr. Onichi. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments and to parties for the helpful briefs. The matter is submitted and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.